Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
So my intention for the next hour and a half is not to have an introduction to a big complicated medieval theology topic where I talk for an hour and then you ask me questions for 30 minutes, which is how a number of my other TI talks go. This is the first run for this, so let me know what you think of it at the end. And I wanted this to be kind of more interactive and also hopefully an occasion to take serious philosophical and theological ideas and apply them to how you begin to think about ordering the rest of your life now and after college. So my hope is that it has kind of some direct application and that, we can have time for questions at the very end, but that we can also have some time for interaction along the way. And that is very much built into the structure. I was telling Seamus, it's very nice to be here. I probably came to Williams on a college tour my junior year, which was now a very long time ago. And so it's good to be back. I then went to Swarthmore, so I have great affection for small liberal arts colleges. And I haven't been on an actual small liberal arts college campus in a while. So very, very nice to be here. So I wanted to start by just setting the context for why I would think about doing something like this. So why sort of think about how to make the decisions that then kind of go on and shape our life. So there are three kind of images. The first is this. Picture a young, high-achieving senior in college who has not only many possibilities before her at the end of her time in college, but also comes to them with many of the awards that her college can bestow upon her. She has made the dean's list. She has had, a thesis win a prize in her department. She's collected her Phi Beta Kappa key. And she's sitting in the office of one of her kind of trusted professor advisors. And instead of excitement at the various possibilities that lie before her, she is paralyzed. She doesn't look happy. She looks very nervous. Her face is taut. She's probably fidgeting with her hands. And she feels kind of paralyzed by the different options, the different choices that are before her, not liberated or excited. This image comes from a book called Why We Are Restless by Ben and Jenna Story, who are a couple who taught at Furman for many years and now are at the American Enterprise Institute in D.C. And they write of this student, she's made the most of her American birthright to pursue happiness wherever it leads, and her very success has left her at a loss. Years of steady progress have culminated in a strange and restless paralysis. And I want to suggest that if that is not you right now, it will probably be some of your friends in another month or in a year or two and a month. Or it may be you at some point. Because I think this is kind of a common situation that high-achieving students end up finding themselves in. So that's scenario number one. Scenario number two is a story from a friend of mine who works with a lot of Princeton students and who bemoaned to me the fact that they have that a number of them, especially the guys, have a sense of what they want to choose, of what might be good for them, but that they kind of fail to act on it. So there's a great fellowship, and he hears all about the fellowship. There's a cute girl, and he hears all about the girl. And he says, okay, well, did you apply for the fellowship? Well, they kind of never got around to applying for it. He asks about the girl. Okay, well, did you, take her to coffee? Well, for whatever reason, they never got around to taking her coffee. And so he sort of said, okay, I need to do something about this and help people actually move from perceiving that something's good for them to actually like acting on it. And the third thing is just beginning to think about my own life. I'm now a few months shy of 40, which is sort of astonishing. And the various major decisions that I've had to make, the various anxieties and about uncertainty, about the potential cost and difficulty that I've had to face, but also the depths of joy and satisfaction that I couldn't have anticipated on the far side of those decisions. And I think that, in my own case, has been true especially of religious conversion, marriage, and becoming a father, which I want to touch on. So I'm now beginning to reflect on those choices, living inside the world that they have created. So I want us, kind of with those in mind, I want us to look at how we make important decisions in our lives, how we can make them well, how we can choose things that let us and those we love flourish. And I want to especially focus on things that require some kind of leap of faith. If not religious faith, then things that require a kind of throwing yourself towards some kind of opportunity and that will transform you in a deep way, right? Decisions that we make where we can't know exactly what we're deciding. We can't know how those decisions are going to shape us going forward. Now, first, I want to have us just look a bit about where we might find breakdowns in the process of making an important decision, right? And I want us to think back again about the students at Furman or the students at Princeton that I mentioned earlier, right? Someone maybe who can't decide what to do after graduation or who can't kind of follow through on something that seems like a good option. So I want to use the schema from Thomas Aquinas's Summa Theologiae, which is found in the first part of the second part. And whenever you deal with the Summa, it's good to know where you are because the part that you're dealing with is there for a reason. So Thomas Aquinas talks about how we make decisions when he's showing how human beings act on the trajectory of their life either toward God or away from God, right? And I've given you there on your handout, that's the first thing, this little kind of simplified schematic. The long version is there in the Summa. I tell you where to find it. I'm happy to talk if you want to read it in more than bullet point form about where to find it later. But the bullet point form version goes something like this. Generally, we desire what is good for us. And this is very, for those of you in philosophy, you're going to recognize this is very much shaped by Aristotle and the Nicomachean Ethics. We desire what's good for us generally. Then we perceive a particular good thing as an end or a goal that we want to pursue. Next, we deliberate, we take counsel on the means by which we're going to go and attain that end, right? And then we make a choice to act, and Thomas breaks that down into a number of things. We sort of tell ourselves what to do, and then we actually do it. So there's a kind of a movement from internal to external. And then we reflect on and enjoy the good that we attained as the result of our action, right? Unless, of course, it was a bad action, in which case we lament what happened as a result. So if you look at this schema, where do you think the problems come? If you think about decisions that you have had to make, or what you imagine kind of your peers making, or what you've seen people who are a little older, maybe in their early 20s out of college deal with, where are the points of breakdown that you identified in your comment? Yeah?
It jumps out to me immediately is between 3 and 4, deliberating and taking counsel, and discussing a decision, and then actually taking action on the decision.
Okay. Yeah, no, exactly. I think there are a number of answers, and I want to kind of put them all out on the table. Yeah, exactly. So one of them is like, what are sort of the means that you could use to attain a particular end, right? So maybe you want to go, I mean, a good example might be, okay, I want to go to law school. Well, which law school do I go to, right? So let's put that out. Okay, so one potential breakdown is there. Others? Yeah.
Maybe like 2, so the perception of the thing maybe not being as like good as you initially thought it was.
Okay. Yeah, and I think one of the things that we also struggle with, we're basically told, and feel free to correct me if you think I'm wrong about this, we're basically told, oh yeah, go and kind of basically do whatever you want, right? As long as it doesn't hurt other people or break the law. But we're not really given a hierarchy for the various good things that we can choose, right? Like if you had to choose between doing a summer internship in a big city and doing something else close to home where you're going to be near your grandmother, say, who's ailing, right? And so you have like, okay, do I do the kind of more prestigious thing that looks better on my resume? Or do I do something that gives me more time with someone who I value and respect and feel like I owe something toward her? It feels like, wait, those are kind of like, how do I even begin to think about weighing those, right? And I think there's also a question in there too about like, what is actually good for us, right? And I think that's another point where people really struggle, not just in the sense of like, okay, you know, again, maybe we'll use a job example, like, okay, I want to, you know, go into finance. I want to go work at Morgan Stanley or Goldman or something like that. Like, am I actually going to be happy? Am I doing, you know, like I hear all about income inequality or something, like, am I doing something good? You know, I can think of at least one friend of mine who, you know, worked probably around the time many of you were, who were born, you know, who finished Princeton, went off to work at Morgan Stanley, and had this moment where he said, hey, wait a minute, like, I think we're actually sort of making a number of financial decisions that are going to have serious ramifications pretty soon. So he left Morgan Stanley, and a few years later, in 2008, you all know what happened to the stock market. So another thing, and I think that's one that I really want to focus on, is what is good for us and how do we weigh different goods? Yeah, what's another potential area of breakdown? Yeah.
When I think about like workaholics, I think the breakdown sort of happens in five, when you sort of like are able to achieve things, but you don't ever stop and appreciate it and like take a second and, you know, you just continue to go on to the next one without ever having a break.
That's a great one, and that's not one that I had considered before, but I think that's exactly right. And you also then don't take the time to kind of step back and ask, like, what am I doing this for, right? If you haven't started to ask that yet, you will eventually, or like a number of your peers will, when they're in their later 20s or in their early 30s, all of a sudden will say, like, okay, so I've climbed the ladder, and now I'm like kind of at the top of the ladder or higher up, like, What am I doing this for? That's great. Any others you want to identify? There's one other that I would point out, and that's a problem here in number four, right? What Aquinas might call a lack of command. Again, where we identify something, but there's something holding us back. Maybe it's just like sloth. We can't just like get the gumption up to, you know, send in the application to text the person to go get coffee or dinner, right? But there's kind of a problem of actually taking the step to pursue something that we perceive as good and then following through with or committing to it. So why do some of these problems arise? And I think they've taken especially acute form for young people today. So in 2008, right after I finished college, a guy named Mark Edmondson at UVA described the college students that he taught as living in a realm of possibility. And he saw that as being in part fueled by computers and the internet, right? Smartphones were just, they were more than a twinkle in Steve Jobs' eye, but they were like a year or two old, right? And he sees computers, the internet, smartphones as simulators of desire, right? So having many different clothes to buy, having different people to date, different classes to take, different parties to go to is a lot more thrilling than actually picking one. And when you pick one, right, sometimes things are kind of a letdown, right? It's more fun to text about what party to go to than it is to actually go to the party. And he said, and then my students would tell me, like, once they got to the party, they would just text each other about what party to go to next, right? And so he concluded, for students now, life is everywhere. Classes matter to them, but classes are just part of an ever-enlarging web of activities and diversions. Students now seek to master their work, not to be taken over by it and consumed. They want to dispatch it, to do it well and quickly, and then to get on to the many other things that interest them. For my students live in the future and not in the present. They live with their prospects for success and pleasure. They dwell in possibility. So my next question to you is, do you think this still describes, if not you, then at least kind of your peers, the atmosphere here at Williams? And what are some of the advantages or disadvantages? Like, it seems like living in a realm of possibility could be incredibly freeing because you have more choices. You can kind of, in theory, do more what you want. Are there downsides to that? Yeah.
Lewis put it well. It's difficult to be present and to appreciate the things that you do have when there are so many opportunities and you're constantly in that state of trying to progress and work and achieve and obtain more.
Mm-hmm. Other thoughts? Yeah.
There's the Emily Dickinson poem that's titled "A Dwell in Possibility," and the next line is "A Fair House of Prose," which that kind of indicates how exciting it is, more thrilling than actually making a decision.
Okay.
And the downside of that is the sort of paralysis of choice, where there's so much available, and being in the present state is so much more thrilling than actually choosing one that you become immobilized.
Yeah, so maybe becoming immobilized is another good part. Another thing that I found as I thought about this is that, you know, it's thrilling, but it's also unfulfilling. It doesn't require a lot of you, but it also doesn't give back a lot to you. And more recently, kind of writing in this similar vein, a Harvard Business School professor named Mihir Desai wrote an op-ed in the Harvard Crimson called "The Trouble with Optionality." And he writes that optionality, right, for those of us who are not in the financial world, I'm very much not in the financial world, he writes that optionality refers to financial instruments known as options that confer the right to do something rather than an obligation to do something. So for this reason, options have a heads I win, tails I don't lose character, what those in finance lovingly describe as a nonlinear payoff structure. So when you hold an option and the world moves with you, you enjoy the benefits. When the world moves against you, you're shielded from the bad outcome since you're not obligated to do anything. Optionality is the state of enjoying possibilities without being on the hook to do anything. And his argument is that this kind of outlook works well in assembling a financial portfolio, and it works very badly in trying to assemble a life. But students who are really excited about possibilities and are training to assemble financial portfolios might not recognize that that doesn't translate well into how to actually build a good life, right? So he says that he sees many young people go to a prestigious university, work at McKinsey for 2 years, go to Harvard Business School, work at Goldman, leave Goldman for Blackstone, et cetera, right? Kind of climbing the ladder that I mentioned earlier. And he worries that those students acquire a series of stamps of approval. They have safety nets, but those don't allow them to pursue other important goods. So instead of examining the goods they want to pursue and making the sacrifices to pursue them, they make sure there are always other options on the table. But they fail to understand that the choices they make change them and make them into a certain kind of person. And they also fail to understand that the most important choices in life, like marriage, it's the one he cites, involve taking options off the table, right? One of my great mentors talked about how the word decide comes from the Latin decidere, which those of you who are classicists in the room will know means to cut off, right? So when you make a serious decision, you choose one thing and you cut off other options, right? So Desai says you might call marriage the death of optionality, right? So what should we do when we're faced with these kind of serious decisions where you have to cut off some options, leave the realm of possibility, and come into the realm of actuality? And Desai says one of the things, and we'll come back to this later, that we need is just courage, right? And we need to acknowledge the risks that attend the choices we make and still pursue rewarding careers or relationships, even when they lead to the unknown or when they cut off other options. And so I think this is true if the if your problems when you're trying to make a decision are number four there, right? If they're problems of command. But what about some of those other problems in either two or three, right? Where you're deliberating about different options or where you're still kind of confused about what's actually good. Now, I think if we think of ourselves as rational decision makers, when we're faced with something like that, we might make a list of pros and cons, right? I bet you've done this many times in your life. And my favorite, currently, my favorite pro-con list comes from Charles Darwin, who, as you will see on your handout, as a young man, one day sat down to weigh the pros and cons of marriage. And if nothing else, this is a great argument against becoming famous and significant, because then your diaries die with you and they are not immortalized in the Cambridge University library system and broadcast all over the internet. So this diary comes from Charles Darwin's diary in July 1838, which is 4 months before he would propose to the woman who became his wife, Emma Wedgwood. I'm wondering if someone can read these out to us and if we can ask ourselves, what happens as Darwin embarks on this calculation? What do you see happening to him? Think about this as a character in a novel, right? What do you see happening to him? What do you make of the reasons that he gives? And what do they tell us about his calculations? And what do they tell us about decisions like marrying someone as a genre? Who wants to read this for us? Go for it.
Charles Darwin Diary, July 1938. This is the question. Marry. Children, if it please God. Constant companion. A friend in old age who will feel interested in one object to be beloved and played with. Better than an old dog anyhow. Home and someone to take care of house. Charms of music and female chit-chat. These things, good for one's health, but terrible loss of time. My God, it is intolerable to think of spending one's life, of one's whole life, like a neuter bee, working, and nothing after all. No, won't do. Imagine living all one's days solitary in a smoky, dirty London house. Only picture to yourself a nice, soft wife on a sofa with a good fire and books and music, perhaps. Compare this vision with the dingy reality of Gerbert Marlborough Street. Mary, Mary, Q-E-D. Not Mary. Freedom to go where one liked. Choice of society and little of it. Conversation of clever men at clubs. Not forced to visit relatives and to bend in every trifle. To have the expense and anxiety of children. Perhaps quarreling. Lots of time. Cannot read in the evenings. Fatness and idleness. Anxiety and responsibility. Less money for books, and see,
etc. Yeah.
Yep. If many children forced to gain one bread, but then it is very bad for one's health to work too much. Perhaps my wife won't like London. Then the sentence is banishment and degradation into indolent, idle fool. It being proved necessary to marry, when? Soon or late.
Okay, great. So, let's go over some of those things that I ask. What happens, what do you see happening kind of in Darwin as he embarks on this calculation, as he makes his pro-con list? You look like you have something.
I,
or are you just amused?
I know, I'm just amused by it.
It's so great. The whole thing about, like, his main concern being that you can't, you know, you have less money for books, you might have to actually work to support your family. Oh my goodness! You know, like he already sees like his mother-in-law that he's going to have to go visit, right? It's just priceless. It's just priceless. So what? Maybe we'll step back and think of it another way. So what do you make of his reasons? Like, are these good reasons to marry or not get married? This seems to be pretty genuine, right? Yeah.
It seems like his reasons to marry are, like, sort of, like, parts of his soul that he wants to have filled in, like, his later life, and, like, you know, he wants to feel fulfilled and, like, have, like, a deep relationship, and then is not married, or sort of just, like, annoyances. Like, there's not really anything, like, too existential. It's all just sort of, like, little annoying things here and there. And to me, I sort of got the impression that he was coming to his realization, like, throughout it, and it sort of seems that he sort of, like, realized that there's a different type of weight to one versus the other.
Hmm. Okay. Yeah.
He also puts loss of time on both of them, which is, like, strikes me kind of strangely. It's like, yeah, and as you get older, you're going to lose, like, time. It's not really that much of, like, a quantitative thing you really put on there.
Okay. Other thoughts? When I look at this, there are two things that jump out at me, right? The first is kind of like what you were saying a second ago, right? His descriptions of marriage are what you would perceive from the outside. Right, they're kind of superficial, right? His vision of what a wife is going to look like is definitely superficial, right? I imagine that none of the women in this room, when they when the time comes for someone to get down on one knee, wants to hear better than a dog, anyhow, right? So for Darwin, like, the risks and the sacrifices are clear. The rewards are maybe a little more substantial, but not by much. But what's interesting is that I think you watch him discover that this is the kind of decision that can't be made by a kind of pro-conlex, by a utilitarian calculus, right? And you watch that because I think actually this exercise in weighing the pros and cons for him becomes a discernment of important human goods, right? He comes to discover what he needs and desires, or he uncovers needs and desires that he didn't choose, but that are there and that are kind of a deeper part of who he is, right? Even if they're superficial, I think he's kind of getting somewhere. And what's interesting, right, is that Darwin is someone who's, of course, famous for being a rigorous scientist. And those of you who know anything about proofs will recognize that this is not a rigorous proof, right? Especially because we got to the conclusion before we even started to list any of the things against marriage, right? So it seems like what's happened is that he's actually kind of uncovered what he wants to do in the process in a way that just a purely utilitarian calculus couldn't have really led him to, right? And I think that this is kind of an apt way to... I should also add, a few months later, he gets engaged to Emma Wedgwood. They marry. They have a long and happy marriage. They have, I think, about 9 children, 3 of whom die, right? So one of the things that's not on here, right, is consolation when 3 of your children die, right? That's not something that he can kind of look ahead to. He can see the superficial things. But life kind of catches up to Darwin, and he is able to enjoy the kind of real goods, the real benefits of marriage. So I think this helps illustrate that in cases like marriage, right, the object of our choice is a new way of life. It's a new horizon along which our life unfolds. And when we make a choice to take vows of marriage or to take vows of celibacy, to embrace a vocation, not in the sense of like what's on your business card, but in the sense of what's, again, the trajectory of your life. When you make the choice to welcome children into your life, you choose a new framework from within which you then act and make all the other choices of your life. And the only way that you can really know what that's like is after you've made the decision, by inhabiting from within. By inhabiting kind of the structure from within, right? And that's why Darwin's calculus is that of a young bachelor, right? He's writing from outside of marriage. And a philosopher at the University of Chicago, Agnes Callard, writes about this very list. And she says, okay, but what alternative does Darwin have? The distinctively first-person joys of married life are all but invisible to the person who's not yet partaken of them, right? And so I want to spend some time exploring this reality that when it comes to life's most significant choices, we can choose what we think will be good for us, but we don't actually fully know what we're choosing. And there's a philosopher at Yale named L.A. Paul who explores this paradox in a book that she wrote, I think in 2016, called Transformative Experience. Right. And she says, we instinctively think about making major decisions by considering the question at hand in light of what our values are or in light of what we care about, right? And we also imagine, we also make decisions by imagining their results and how they correspond to our current desires and beliefs, right? So probably when you were applying to college, you said, okay, well, if I go to Williams, it'll be like this based on who I am today, and that'll be good for me, right? And if I go somewhere else, that would be bad for me. I'm not going to go there. I'll come to Williams, right? But for the most significant choices of our lives, we only learn what the decision entails after we make it. And this, Paul says, creates something of a dilemma. We only get the information that we would need to make the decision with full knowledge after we have actually already committed to that particular choice. And even if we try to escape the dilemma, even if we say, okay, I'm not going to do it at all, right? Like, I'm not going to get married. I'm not going to have kids. I'm not going to go for that job. That is still making a choice. That's still creating a horizon along which your life is going to flow, right? So either way, you're confronted with a choice whose outcomes, whose potential goods, and whose impact on your life you can't fully anticipate. So Paul refers to choices like this as transformative experiences, and she describes them as epistemically and personally transformative. That's the next section there on your handout, I think. An epistemically transformative experience, right? Epistemic, for those of you who not philosophers, means referring to knowledge or kind of how we know and apprehend reality. It's a technical philosophical term. An epistemically transformative experience is one that teaches you something you could not have learned without having that kind of experience. So once you've had this experience, you can perceive and imagine experiences like it in a way that would have been impossible before, right? I'm now married. I now can perceive what that is like when someone else tells me in a way that I couldn't before. I'm just going to make that as like a testament, like that is true of me. A personally transformative experience changes you in a deeper way. It changes the level of core values, desires that you have. It changes how you understand the kind of person you take yourself to be. And so Paul combines these, and she says a transformative experience, in her terms, changes you both epistemically and personally. So it gives you new knowledge, and it makes you into a different person. And she thinks that transformative experiences pose a problem for authentic, rational decision-making, right? We can't grasp the outcomes of our future acts, nor can we grasp the ways in which they will change our perspectives. And so transformative experiences change us in significant ways that we can't see. And as a result, she writes, having the new experience can dramatically change how your post-experience self values the outcomes, including your valuing of your higher order values, creating a problem for how you are to adjudicate between these sets of preferences. And I want to just point out, I don't think it's a coincidence that the two philosophers I've just cited here are women who would have written these articles in their late 40s or early 50s, right? After they have tried to balance family and having children, both of these women have children, with also having an academic career in philosophy at an elite institution in the U.S., which is also true for both of them. But leaving them aside, right, if you're an evangelical who converts to Roman Catholicism, if you're a woman who decides to have children, there's no way of knowing what your Catholic self is going to be like, what your maternal self is going to be like, and whether or not those decisions will make you happy or fulfilled, right? And so Callard further explores the character of these kind of personal decisions, right? Again, these decisions that can't be chosen just with clear rational calculation by contrasting them with major public decisions. In her example is the decision by which President Obama and his advisors and the U.S. military, right, decided to raid the compound in Afghanistan where Osama bin Laden was hiding out. And so she says, okay, suppose that Obama and his staff are in the Situation Room. They have a crystal ball. They look into the crystal ball. They see the results of the raid. And so they would do so with clear markers of success and failure, right? They see that the Marines succeed in killing bin Laden. And so they say, okay, we're going to go ahead with this. But Callard says, okay, look, could you take that crystal ball out of the Situation Room? Could you take it into your dorm room? Could you look at the same crystal ball and see whether going to college, whether emigrating to another country, whether marrying a particular person would make you happy in 20 or 40 years? And she says, what do I look for to check whether the undertaking was a success? Do I look to see if she, the person, picture of myself in 20 years is smiling? Do I look to see how wealthy my future self is? These metrics won't do. Perhaps my future self does not care to smile all the time. Perhaps she's less interested in wealth than I currently am. These changes in her might have been connected to her finding some kind of happiness that I can't yet fathom. What makes big decisions big is that they set into motion changes not only in the outside world, but in ourselves. Becoming a mother means having new desires, feelings, habits, knowledge, and even new decision-making procedures. And I would flag in my own experience, this is also true of becoming a father. So, of course, that's not to say that there's no room for deliberative decision-making, right? If we look back at the breakdown from Aquinas, that part of weighing decisions and counsel, pro-comlis, deliberative decision-making are very valuable for that kind of step, right? When we need to choose between a variety of means to attain it. But when the end is less clear, I think the limits of our reasoning become apparent. And that's where Callard says, sometimes you just need to step forward with uncertainty in a future that you cannot rubber stamp in advance. So that's if that's kind of setting up the problem of the talk, I want to spend the next part going through some ways in which I think Catholic theology can help us think about this, both in a theoretical and in a practical way, and help us think about how we make life-changing decisions, right? So the first thing I would say is that we have to recognize, and this is to some degree an echo of Callard and of Paul, that choices like these are an inescapable part of human life. To shy away from them is still itself a choice. That part of our existence as finite human beings means that our comprehension is limited, means that our control over the development and destiny of our life is limited, that we don't have a capacity to fully plan and prepare, and uncertainty remains a part of the human condition. And we can hack a lot of things in life. There are a lot of systems we can hack. We can't hack the human condition to the point that we eliminate all uncertainty and control all the options. We first see that in Genesis chapter 3, and then we spend the rest of the Bible watching the attempt to sort of attain full certitude and control break down with disastrous results. So that's point one. Point two is that desiring our happiness and discerning our happiness and making choices accordingly requires us to discern what goods we actually desire. And the Catholic University business professor Luke Burgess, who writes a lot about the Catholic philosopher René Girard. So if any of you are interested in René Girard, I highly recommend Burgess's book. Burgess counsels that this involves thinking that's more meditative than calculative. And I really like that, right? The distinction between the kind of calculative deliberation and something that's more prayerful or meditative. But even calculative thought, as we've seen with Darwin's list, can be helpful when it serves as a tool for pondering our deeper desires. Because I think, and this is in Burgess's terms, it allows the thicker desires to emerge and the thinner desires to, well, thin out, right? And I think sometimes, again, as we saw in that list, there are more superficial desires that actually cloud the things that we long for the most, that kind of get to the core of who we are, right? And so, you know, Darwin's attempt to balance quiet reading time, right, kind of thins out when it comes to abiding companionship. And there's another example I like about this kind of meditative thinking and the failures of calculative thinking. There's a professor of math at Stanford who's also a MacArthur fellow. His name is Percy Diaconis. And he recalled, some years ago, I was trying to decide whether or not to move to Harvard from Stanford. I bored my friends silly with endless discussion. And finally, one of them said, okay, well, you're one of our leading decision theorists. Maybe you should just make a list of the costs and benefits and try to roughly calculate your expected utility. And without thinking, he says, I blurted out, come on, Sandy, this is serious, right? And again, that's not to say that this guy is, right, like, disowning his entire academic specialty, right? But it's that there are certain things that are deeper than utility calculus. And those things are probably unknown to us, right? They're going to change us more, and they require more discernment of our deepest desires and the ways in which those desires correspond to the deepest human goods. And I think instinctively we want these goods. One of the reasons we try to think about them in very calculative terms is that we want them to be rationally comprehensible and controllable, right? You would like to be able to say, okay, if I just devise a proof for the person who I marry, I'll marry the right one and my life will just go a lot better, right? That's not really how marriage works, right? Or, you know, okay, I've kind of figured out that, you know, I've sort of worked out all of the theological arguments, and I think that Catholicism is like 100% irrefutably completely true, so I'm going to be a Catholic, and then, like, there won't be any more doubt, right? That's not how questions like religion work. And so I think it's helpful here to turn to John Henry Newman for how to think about choices that operate more as matters of faith or that require kind of leaps of faith. So in his university sermons, which are kind of a series of lectures he gave to Oxford University, and this, sorry, I gave you a nice big long quotation on your handout that you're all turning to because I said John Henry Newman. That's not what this is. We'll get to him. We'll get to that part of Newman later, though it's a lovely thing that that's there. So Newman, in his university sermons, where Newman is trying to hash out what faith and reason look, what faith and reason actually are, how they operate, especially against critics from kind of more secular Enlightenment perspectives, Newman defines reason as the exercise of the mind by which we move from X evidence to Y conclusion. Right? And he says, for reason broadly conceived, this means moving from some kind of proven evidence to a theoretical conclusion. But faith reasons not from direct empirical evidence placed before us, but from grounds of trust or probability based on inclinations and dispositions of the heart. Right? So if we say we have faith in something, even if we can't prove it, our statement might look something like this. I assent to the doctrine of the incarnation because people I trust taught it to me. Or I believe that human beings have inherent dignity because good people think this way. Or I think that is a miracle that I just saw. You know, say you hear about someone who all of a sudden their cancer is gone, right? After they said such and such prayer or prayed to such and such a saint or something like this. And you say, well, because I've seen a miracle before, hypothesis you have, this looks like that and I've seen miracles before. So faith means moving from probabilities or likelihoods, from inclinations and dispositions of the heart to other conclusions that might not be as sure as a typical rational conclusion. And Newman talks about, he kind of introduces a concept that he calls antecedent probabilities. And he says these are kind of at the heart of faith. So by an antecedent probability, he means something like this. Given the trustworthiness of this source, given the nature of this or this particular historical fact, it's likely that this other thing is the case, right? Even if I can't work a perfectly logical proof. So probabilities aren't reducible to a particular scientific standard, right? They will vary for different people, and they therefore kind of depend on the moral disposition, the moral temperament of each individual. And so one of the things that you need in order to judge probabilities rightly is to have a rightly disposed mind. And so this is Newman's account of religious faith. I can talk a lot more about that if you want later, but I think that it's helpful. I think this account of religious faith works very well for other non-religious decisions or kind of existential wagers that we have to make in life, right? If you're going to convert, as I've given this example before, if you're going to convert to Catholicism or choose to become a doctor or marry someone, it's not because someone made you a perfect, you know, ironclad argument, right? Though arguments might help you get to one of those decisions. And so therefore, you should take time when you're faced with a decision like religious conversion, when you're faced with one of these sort of horizon-setting decisions, to pray over and pay attention to the probabilities that you see in your life, to the desires that you have, the inclinations that you have, the dispositions that you have, and that start to accumulate, that start to lead in particular directions. And you should pray to have a rightly disposed mind so that you know and love clearly, and that you judge and act well. And just by way of kind of giving an example of this, I can say a few words about my own sort of making of these decisions. So I spent most of my time as an undergraduate thinking that I was going to become an Episcopal priest. And I then shot that career path in the foot my senior year of college, right as I was graduating, by becoming a Roman Catholic. And my conversion to Catholicism was itself the convergence of what Newman was talking about, right? Which is how he also understood his own religious conversion, right? It was kind of an accumulation of probabilities, of arguments, of inclinations that led to that decision. And during my work after college and then later in graduate school, I very seriously thought about becoming a Roman Catholic priest. I got an application to a seminary at one point. I made visits to different religious communities. And in the third year of my PhD program, I spent the year becoming good friends with a very nice girl who lived not too far away from me when we were both at Boston College. And I finished my comprehensive exams. I went and did some traveling and visited some more religious communities, including the Dominicans, who are sponsoring this evening's talk, for whom I have enduring affection. And in the meantime, Jane broke up with her boyfriend, and I got that news via email in the common room of an Austrian religious community's novitiate. And I was sitting there at the computer, and I was like, oh, that's interesting. I seem to have complicated feelings about that. Why do I have those? Well, I have a lot of things to see in Vienna today. I'm not going to worry about that. And because I'm a guy, it's a lot easier for guys to do this, I shelved all of those complicated feelings and paid no attention to them and ran around Vienna having a great time. And then a few days later, when I was back in the U.S., they came back to bite me. And I was sitting there praying in a church in New York and thinking, what should I do with my life? What does God want of me? Like, I visited these religious communities and they're beautiful, but I just don't want that life. And like the answer, if there had been a narrative voice, it would have boomed out in this very ugly church, Jane. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. Like, where did that come from? And so I continued thinking about that. And a month or so later, I went out on a date with my very good friend, and then 8 months later, I asked her to marry me, and then a year after that, she married me, and here we are 9 years later. But my point is that in my own experience, clarity about my desires, about those deepest desires, had to emerge over time and kind of come out from a cloud of other desires that were perfectly good. Some of them were superficial and dumb. Others of them were substantive and good. But they needed to kind of emerge from that, right? And a clarity kind of emerged, again, not just about like what I wanted for me, what I wanted to get out of it, but how I was going to love other people, how God had made me to love other people. And again, those were initially obscure. They had to be discovered over time. So that's point two, how to make life-changing decisions. Take time for that meditative, prayerful calculation and that examination of those probabilities and inclinations that have built up in your life. So step three, or idea number three. So at the risk of stating the obvious, right, we also we need help not just sifting through our desires, but identifying which of them are actually good for us, right? If you pay attention to yourself throughout a day and throughout the course of a number of months, you'll notice that you want a lot of things that don't actually make you happy, that don't actually lead to your flourishing. And so we need guides who can help us with that second step on page one of the handout in Aquinas' schema, with the identification of what goods are real, what goods are not real, and what goods actually matter more than others, right? It was very helpful for me when I got married to have the Catholic Church there in the background saying, like, hey, just remember that if you get married, kids are a part of this, right? Kids aren't like an optional accessory that you can get, like a dog or something, right? They are a natural fruit, not present for everyone, but they are a natural fruit of marriage. They're part of the package. And kind of like Darwin, I was very aware of the superficial ways in which children were going to take away my book money, take away my reading time, right? Like, make it harder to just have fun in life, right? And I got that part, and those are all real. But I didn't understand, right, that having children would open up vistas of human experience to me that I just didn't know existed. And so it was really helpful to have the children, to have the church saying, okay, here's how, like, your deepest happiness is going to come from binding yourself to the care and service of others in this way. Your a life of sacrifice on this path is going to actually lead to your greatest flourishing, right? And I think that models of good lives are essential for discernment as well, right? We make decisions not as isolated individuals, but supported by relationships with those who know and love us, right? It's helpful to have people who are older than you. It's helpful to consider the lives of great moral exemplars, right? Like the lives of the saints. And those are helpful in some ways because they can see things that we can't yet, right? Like, we might not understand why we shouldn't marry someone with radically different values. We might not understand why having children is a great thing, right? Or why we should choose a career closer to home and family than not, right? But we would do well to pay attention to the wisdom and practice of our churches, our relations, of great authors like Tolstoy. Tolstoy talks about these kind of things because there are probably reasons for these things, even if we don't know them, right? And I think it's also helpful as a fourth point to kind of think about some of the cardinal and theological virtues when we're faced with major decisions, right? So just by way of a sketch of what this could look like, justice, right, is, say, a career path that I want going to be just, going to kind of make the community that I live in more just? Does it add to the common good of society? Does it detract from it? As I set off on this career path, what obligations do I owe to others? And am I able to give them what they're due, right? I can tell you it looks a lot different to get a PhD in the humanities when you're single than to get a PhD in the humanities when you have a spouse and kids in the picture, right? Same is true of law school, incidentally, or other kind of higher graduate work. You can think about prudence and temperance, right? Is this decision good based on my particular needs and circumstances? Am I doing this just because it lets me do whatever I want more? Because it just gives me more money? Because it just gives me more power or prestige, right? Money, power, prestige, those aren't bad things in and of themselves. They can become very dangerous when pursued in the wrong ways. Fortitude, right? Fortitude, I think, is huge when it comes to this, right? Like, you just need to have the courage, as that Harvard Business School professor was saying, and as I think I think that command in decisions is very much a good application of fortitude if you're thinking in Aquinas' system. You need courage to step out into the unknown in order to live worthwhile and flourishing lives, and to seek what you think will make you happy, even if you don't fully understand how it might change your sense of happiness. And then getting into the theological virtues, love, right? We should remember that our happiness is based in part on the structure of how human beings were created. That's not something that we chose. That's not something that's infinitely plastic and malleable. Even if we can choose to kind of instantiate our happiness through different goods. And we also kind of find our happiness most deeply not in sort of accumulating things for ourselves and in sort of actualizing ourselves as though we're just these sort of glorious, shining, autonomous beings, but in giving ourselves away, in saying yes to others, in sacrificing ourselves. And that's the structure of how we were made. That's how human beings were created. And so our happiness ultimately determines whether or not our lives conform to that logic of giving ourselves away in love, right? And so you want to think about your life not as like, okay, these are all sort of the points I want to rack up, but this is how I'm going to worship God. This is how I'm going to share my life with others. This is how I'm going to die. These are the people who might be with me when I die. And finally, I think faith and hope. I think the greatest aid of all when approaching transformative experiences in L.A. Paul's terms, and I think a great support of courage and prudence, is a deep faith that the ordering of values is ultimately ordained and revealed by God, that God has a plan for me in his divine providence, that God hasn't set before us like a kind of scavenger hunt where we get a clipboard of what we maybe are supposed to be, and we really want to like collect all the things on the clipboard, otherwise we've somehow failed at life. I definitely inadvertently thought about vocational discernment in those terms and kind of had to discover along the way that those aren't the terms in which they should be thought about. And I think we can trust that God will lead us if we open ourselves to him and pursue him, even if the way remains obscure. And we should remember that, you know, by trusting in God's guidance, we face the unknown with the help of one who knows all and who cares for us, and the one who will transform us through our experiences into who he's created us to be. And that this path of transformative experience culminates, hopefully, in our union with him in heaven, right? Which is the most transformative experience of all, the one that we can only begin to imagine, that we can accurately imagine the least, but the one that we trust will bring our greatest happiness. So I want to end the talk there, and I give you here on the handout, which you can read on your own time. I don't think there's a need for us to go through it together. I think a wonderful meditation on divine providence from John Henry Newman, very much based on the trajectory of his religious life, and also just the trajectory of what happened throughout his life otherwise. So I want to end there, and then we have ample time for questions, further conversation, if you want.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.